So this wasn't written down, but a few people asked if we would say something about ourselves, about our meditation history. So we'll just begin just by each of us saying a few words. So for myself, what to say? I finished university in Canada in 1970 and started work and realized that that wasn't what I wanted to be doing. Does that sound familiar? And I took a 6-month leave from my job to travel. And I went to Europe and I spent about 3 or 4 months in Europe traveling around. And then I came and spent 3 months in Israel. And then I went and I spent a month in Istanbul. And then I spent about a month traveling across through Iran and Afghanistan. And you can see I'm already more than 6 months. And then I spent about 7 or 8 months in India. And while in India, I heard about Goenka. I got interested, of course. If you go to India, you can't help but get some kind of interest in the philosophy and the spiritual tradition. So I heard about Goenka. And I did some retreats with Goenka and got addicted to meditation. And for the next 10 years, I spent most of my time in India doing retreats with different teachers and spending a lot of time just going up into the mountains and rent a little cabin and just do retreat by myself. And whenever I ran out of money, I would go back to Canada and work for a little while and then back to India. And just spent the time in that way. So the meditation was the main focus. That was the most important thing in my life for that period. And then in 1980, I went to Thailand and spent some time in a monastery there. And I worked in the Cambodian refugee camps in Thailand also. And spent 3 months in Thailand and then went back to Canada, ran out of money again, went back to Canada, and then for the next 5 years I lived. So all through that time my practice was always Vipassana, not just Goenka but with different teachers and different styles. And then I went back to Toronto and I moved into a Tibetan center, and I lived in a Tibetan Buddhist center for 5 years and studied with lots of different lamas, the different teachers who would come from India. And then in 1985, one of my teachers, Christopher Titmus, who lives in England and comes to teach here in Israel, asked me to come and teach with him in India, in Bodh Gaya. So in 1986 was when I began teaching. So I left the Tibetan center and went to India again after not being there for 5 years, and did some assisting with Christopher, and then from India I went to England and moved into a Buddhist community in Devon, and that was where Molly and I really met. Molly was a manager at the retreat center.
That's my story. You're hedging.
So Molly was managing at the retreat center where I was teaching. So anyway, so we spent some time in England, and then because of visa problems, problem of staying there, moved back to Canada, and spent some years in Canada teaching, and began traveling, going to India each year to teach, and started teaching in Canada and working to survive. And then gradually the teaching, I began getting more and more invitations to teach, and so I started teaching in Canada and teaching in the States and in England and in India, and it got to the point where the town where we were living, we realized that it was time for some kind of a move, some kind of a change, didn't know what. And I was getting enough invitations that I got to the point where I had to either turn down the invitations to teach or leave my job. So we chose to leave everything. And we sold our house and left our jobs and went back to India. And since that time, the teaching has been pretty much full time. We spent about 4.5 years on the road without a home at that point, just traveling, basically traveling from retreat to retreat and from country to country. And then just last fall, we finally resettled in Canada again and have moved into a house. Haven't been there very much since we moved in, but we have a home, happily have a home again, and enjoy the traveling and the teaching and the opportunity to meet with people like yourselves and to really share the Dharma and to share my experience and my love for the Dharma.
Oh gosh. So I had a very kind of normal life for a good part of my adult life. I had a home and a child and a different husband, and I taught art in public school, and there was always a sense that something was missing. I mean, it clearly was. I kind of was born into a life, conditioned into a life that put on a coat, and it just never felt right, didn't fit. But I had absolutely no exposure to any kind of alternative life, and certainly not Buddhism until many years later. And so through the course of events, my marriage broke up. And at some point I got one of those mysterious illnesses that now they have lots of names for, but then they didn't. And I had to take some time off from my job. And during that time, two things happened. One is in terms of trying to get better, I started meditating, I think 5 minutes. Was what I did with some direction with a woman who is a Feldenkrais practitioner and a counselor, and she started me meditating. And at the same time, I met a man who was a good friend, and he had spent 7 years traveling in Asia and had very close contact with Hinduism as well as Buddhism. And I'll never forget the feeling of kind of, it was like someone opened a window or opened a door, and I looked in, and it was like, yes, this is what I've been waiting for. And I was like a little kid. It was finding the biggest, most incredible treasure ever. And so at some point I had to go back to work. And I was there for maybe a half an hour, and I realized I can't do this anymore. I can't do this. And somehow there was the courage to walk away from that. And I did my first formal retreat, coincidentally, however word you want to use, with Christopher Titmus. Was also one of Norman's main teachers in Massachusetts. And I noticed that there was so much fear in going to this. It was a 3-day retreat, and I think I left after the second day. It was a long weekend, and I figured, oh, 2 days is plenty. And I saw how much fear there was in going into a situation that was completely unknown for me. And so I don't know where this really came from, but I decided that I would use that as that was kind of a signal that I needed to do more of this. And my son was going to university. This was in the spring, and he was going to university the following fall. And the relationship I was in was going nowhere. And so, you know, I was a very timid person. I still am in a lot of ways, but I was really, really not a very brave person. And somehow I decided, okay, I'm going to go around the world. This is how I was going to get used to being in different places, different environments. So I had these wonderful plans, and I did. Goenka came to Massachusetts that summer, and I sat a longer retreat with him. And then I did one other retreat in the tradition that we're teaching here now. And I decided, okay, it was October, and I left. I got rid of my flat. I sold most of my stuff. And my first stop was Scotland, Finhorn, which is an alternative community in Scotland. And I was there for a while. And then I went to Nepal was very sick. And then the plan was for me to arrive in India when the Dalai Lama was giving very special teachings in Bodh Gaya. And I still, you know, it's amazing to retell this story. I have no idea how I ever did this. And when I was there in Bodh Gaya, and really kind of submerged in Tibetan Buddhism, and very, very sick from being in India, I found out that Christopher Titmus was giving two back-to-back 10-day retreats, also in Bodh Gaya, right after the Kala Chakra teachings. And that was the first year that Norman taught in Bodh Gaya. So he was also at the Kala Chakra teachings, though we didn't meet, and he was also on this retreat that I did in India. And I just loved it so much. And the manager of that retreat kind of planted the seed, because he knew I was homeless and hadn't a clue what was going to come next. And he said, well, maybe come back to England and be a manager at Gaia House. So that stayed in the head. And I traveled around India. Oh, just loved the retreat and loved being in India. And traveled around and went back and landed where my parents were living, and spent some time. I'm from the States originally, and spent some time in the States feeling lost. No clue about what I was going to do or where I was going to go, and I didn't fit anywhere anymore. And so I got a one-way ticket to England and went and visited some friends and did some stuff in Scotland, and really almost had a kind of breakdown of just not knowing and really not having the practice and the skills to deal with it. And I had a dream. Oh, I'm using up all the time. Oh, yeah. This is so much fun.
Good, here are questions, Dave.
Yeah. And I had a dream, and Christopher came to me in the dream and said, get yourself to Gaia House. I was in Scotland. This is in Devon. And so, okay, I'll do that. And so somehow I got a ride, and I got there, and I said, oh, this is a horrible place. I'm staying one week retreat. And I was there 2 months on retreat. And then I started managing, and so happy there. And then Norman started teaching there, and so we connected. And he refused to go to the States. So I ended up in Canada with him because that was how we could be together. And so the Vipassana tradition has been the strongest practice in my life. But I've also spent some time in India with two different Hindu gurus, Hindu teachers in the Advaita Vedanta tradition, the non-dual tradition. And I've also done several retreats with Stephen and Martine Batchelor in the Korean Zen tradition, all of which have really touched my heart and are threads through whatever is expressed and whatever is lived. And so when we moved to Canada and Norman started teaching, I organized the retreats and was the manager. And then I went back to school and studied homeopathy in England, and then went back to Canada and practiced for a while. And then Norman invited me to join him teaching. And when we sold our home, I mean, we had no idea what would happen, and I certainly had no idea whether I would continue practicing homeopathy or whether anything would happen with the teaching. And the first invitation that came to both of us that was outside Canada was here in Israel. And so that was my kind of international beginning. And it was wonderful. It was very scary, but it was wonderful. So it's always just a delight to come back. And that's...
And here we are.
And here we are. And here we are. So that was fun. Thanks for the question. It's fun to connect with the wonder of life. And So I'll start. It's on. Oh.
Will it work now?
We'll try doing this back and forth. Take another 5 minutes. You hold it for me and I'll hold it for you. Okay. There are several questions that seem to be more practice related. So I'll try to answer those. How to work on pains in life, in disease, chronic pain, with Vipassana tools. So I think we've talked, we've touched on a number of times different techniques to work with pain during the sitting meditations. And by meeting them, by bringing attention to them, by the willingness to bear witness to the pain, to be steady with the pain, and bring interest and a sense of curiosity to it. And those same tools work or are helpful, can be a support, whether the pains are here in the meditation hall, or sitting at the computer, or in a body that's not well. No?
This is my question, and I want to emphasize, when someone is sick and has chronic disease, and
yes,
it is hopeless,
yes,
not voluntary like sitting in meditation, yes, on computer, it is for life.
Yes.
It needs...
Yes. So the second part of the answer, which I hope will address that more, is the relationship to the pain. So there are situations in life, as Nadar just said, that we really don't have any choice. There's no escape hatch. We can't get up from the computer. We can't get up from the meditation hall. We can't get up from our cushion and do standing meditation, or go for a walk, or have a cup of tea, or turn on the TV, or call a friend. Sometimes the body, in fact for all of us at some point, the body's gonna quit in some degree or other. And so I think the really most important aspect is, what is our relationship to the pain. Can we open? Can we open to it with heart? If there's resistance or fear, can we acknowledge that and open to that as well? And let that have its life. I hope that all of you have had at least one experience, one taste here on the retreat of how the willingness to open to be steady with whatever is arising, whether it's physical pain or emotional pain, how that change of relationship from trying to get rid of it or trying to change it can actually transform it. That is the support. And also to see, to really see and understand that whatever arises in body, in mind, is it mine? Is it me? Or is it this anatta, this co-arising? And I think the understanding of that, that this, like everything else, is not in my control. It arises dependent on many conditions, and it passes dependent on many conditions. And hopefully, a deep experience of that, or even a taste of that, can help to loosen the grip, loosen the hold on it, and allow it to be present, and yet not to have a struggle with it, to be able to make some peace with it. It's almost like treating it like family. You know, they're part of our life. It's part of the connection of our lives. And even if we're far from it, it's still a connection. It's still part of our life. And we try our best to make peace with our family, with our mothers and our fathers and our children, our partners. And I think that's a similar thing with this body. And metta, the practice of metta, the practice of compassion, the practice of appreciation, the practice of equanimity, are very, very powerful tools. And my experience is the more my back is up against a wall, when I really have a sense that there is no way out, the more the heart is willing and the mind is willing to really surrender to what's happening and to open the heart with the metta, with these Brahmavihara practices, in a way that they can really help give support. They can really free the clinging, free the needing to be with any, to be for whatever the difficulty is, to be any special way. And can we approach death as we approach life? Second question. I don't know what's so funny. The second question is about lying down meditation. I'm just having a little trouble with the laughter after that last question, but you know what? Sometimes one extreme of emotion gives rise to another, so peace with it. So how to do lying down meditation. As we've said, the Buddha taught meditation in four postures, standing, sitting, walking, and lying down. And we don't teach a lot of lying down meditation in the hall because the idea is to wake up. And a lot of us are on the verge of going to sleep. So just to give some suggestions, it's a wonderful, wonderful practice. It's a wonderful practice, especially if one is really very fatigued, if one is ill. It can be wonderful doing the first thing in the morning before getting out of bed, or the last thing at night before turning out the light, just lying in bed. So there's several instructions. One, in lying down, you can just bring attention to the general totality of body. Sound familiar? And really to be aware of the contact of the whole body with the bed or the floor. You can also do the body scan very well in the lying down posture. And something that I do before I go to sleep at night, which really for me helps relax me and ease the transition to sleep, is I just bring the attention to the breath. And as the breath slows down, it's a lot easier lying down. And I just, as I'm aware of breathing in, I just say, in breath, or just in. And as I'm aware of breathing out, I just say, out breath, or out. And the rhythm of the breath and the rhythm of just those words can be very, very relaxing. So almost any of the techniques that we use in the sitting meditation are fine to use in the lying down meditation. If you're doing lying down meditation because you're really tired and you're not feeling well, but you want to be awake, not to use it to go to sleep, then it helps to lie down but have one arm up. Because if you start to get sleepy, that'll be the first indication, and it's a good wake-up call. One more?
Yeah, we're going to do those three.
Oh, right. Yeah. Oh, but then there's... Oh, okay. Okay. I'm combining mindfulness of the mind with breathing, and it really helps. Is that okay to mix them together? I would say you can do them together in the same meditation, but I wouldn't suggest trying to bring the attention to both the breath and the mind at exactly the same time. That's a good recipe for confusion and, So, it's good to choose one object. So perhaps have the breath as the object of meditation. And as the awareness naturally, you know, you all of a sudden realize I'm with the mind. The attention is with stories or feelings or emotions. Then bring mindfulness to that in the way that we've talked about. And when that changes or passes, then bring the attention back to the breath. There are times when there's a lot of steadiness, and then a whole sitting period can be devoted to mindfulness of the mind. But I wouldn't suggest that unless there's real steadiness. So it's good to have an object, a body-related object, and then just, as the attention naturally goes to the mind, come back. So I hope that answered that one adequately. Your turn.
Phew, used a lot of time.
Oh, dear.
Okay, so I'll try and give some short answers to these so we can get through a good number of them. But I have to pick the easy ones. Do I have to believe in karma and incarnation in order to fully grasp and strive my way for ending my dukkha? In order to fully ungrasp and unstrive. So, I would guess the intention here is, do I have to believe in karma and reincarnation? Because obviously we believe in incarnation, because here we are. we have incarnated. So reincarnation is the idea of rebirth. And one way of viewing this is in the sense of, when this Norman dies, something gets reborn, which is some kind of a continuation of Norman. So it's a rebirth. And that kind of reincarnation, I would say, you don't have to believe in. If you want to believe in it, fine. If it helps you, fine. If you don't believe in it, fine. Hopefully we'll all have enough mindfulness, enough wakefulness, that when we die, then we'll find out if it's true or not. Another way of looking at reincarnation is more in terms of the present. And if we look more in the present, we can see, I think, and this is where reincarnation and karma. So karma, the word itself actually means action. And what it refers to is cause and effect. So actions having results. Okay, so our karma is our actions that have results. And karma and reincarnation are very much connected. So if we look at reincarnation more in the present, and in terms of karma, we can see that our actions in the present have results. And in a way, the result, when there's this Norman here, he does some action, and there's a result, the Norman in the time of that result is different than the Norman at the time of the action. Okay, so what's an example? If I take the action of standing on my head, before I stand on my head, I'm a certain way, I'm standing here a certain way. After I stand on my head, after I take the action, I've changed. Okay? So, in a sense, there's a new Norman. Okay? I take the action of eating a meal. All right? I sit down at the table, and there I am sitting, and I eat my meal. There's the action. At the end of the meal, I've changed. Especially if I've eaten too much. Okay, so and these changes, even these kinds of changes, are not just physical, but the physical changes will also affect the mind. So when I stand on my head, I'm going to think differently. I'm going to be thinking differently than I was before I stood on my head. After I eat too much, the mind is different. Maybe you've noticed that at lunchtime. After lunch, it's a lot more drowsy and tired than before lunch. Okay, so in a sense, so there's a change. The person at the time of the result isn't the same as the person at the time of the action. So the action creates something new. Okay, if that's too complicated for you, just forget it.
Is that the reincarnation?
Okay, so that's the reincarnation. Okay, so the karma, again, is the cause and effect. So do I have to believe in karma? Okay, I would say I guess you don't have to believe in it, but it's certainly very helpful if we can see from our own experience that our actions do have results, that our actions do have effects. If we don't see that, or if we don't believe it, then there's no point in taking the action. And so if we don't believe or don't see from our own experience that that some action, such as the meditation, contributes to an ending of dukkha, then there's not going to be much point in doing the action. Okay? Does that make sense? So the belief in it is a belief in it is necessary, first of all, to start doing it. So to do the action in the first place, there has to be some idea that, yeah, this might work, let me try this. But then there has to be some belief coming out of actual experience. And when we see in our own experience that it has some beneficial effect, then we continue with it. And so the belief that's really important is the belief that comes out of our own experience. And then it's not really a belief. Then it's knowing. It's not just believing it, it's actually knowing it. It's knowing that our actions cause results. What does Buddhism say about God? Not a lot. what to say? There's a lot of debate. It's often debated: is Buddhism a religion or a philosophy? And people will say, well, it's a religion because it has all these beliefs and it has the texts and it has this and that and it's all about life and relationship and so on. And then other people will say, no, it's not a religion because it doesn't have a God. And other people will say it's just a philosophy, it has nothing to do with religion. But I think the Buddha would have said, doesn't matter. It's not really a religion or a philosophy, and it doesn't matter if you think it is. And what the Buddha, I think, would say about God, actually what he did say about God is that, well, partly it depends on what we mean by God, because different people do have different ideas and different concepts of what God is. If we take the traditional biblical meaning of God as a creator, the Buddha, in some places he said, no, there is no creator. Things come into existence out of conditions. And of course we could argue, well, God is a condition, but that would depend on our how we mean God. But what the Buddha more frequently said was, The aim is to understand suffering and to bring suffering to an end, to know the ending of suffering. And whether there is or isn't a God, it's possible to know the ending of suffering. We can know the ending of suffering whether we believe in a God or not. And so the Buddha didn't say, really, there is or there isn't. He said it's not important. It's not important to know that. So the Buddha wasn't caught up in either religion or in philosophy. What he was interested in was actual life. He was interested in life, in living a life free of dukkha. And to him, it just wasn't important. What kind of emotion is aggression? Aggression, I would say, isn't an emotion in itself. Aggression is an action coming out of emotion. So aggression is an action against oneself or against another. And it can come out of a number of emotions. It can come out of anger. It can come out of fear. It can come out of loneliness. It can come out of what else? Others don't come. Oh, before they came. So aggression is an action. A harmful action that comes out of an emotion.
Greed.
Pardon?
Greed.
Greed, yes, aggression can come out of greed. So the Buddha's teachings are about being free of dukkha, being free from dukkha. And I think we would all agree that aggressive action does not contribute to the ending of dukkha. Aggressive action causes dukkha. And so the teachings and the practices, one of the intentions would be to understand where there is aggression, to understand the causes of the aggression, and to understand it in a way that it comes to an end. The Buddha, I spoke about the Eightfold Path, and in the dining room listed the Eightfold Path, and the second of the Eightfold Path is right intention. And for the Buddha, right intention meant the intention for, first of all, for renunciation, which is a big one. The intention for renunciation, which is the intention for, it applies in many different ways at many different levels. So the intention for living simply, the intention for not holding on, the intention for not getting caught up in the mind of acquisitiveness, of accumulating, of acquiring, of getting, of holding on, of building up the self. The intention, we could say, for non-greed. Yeah, the intention to cultivate a mind of non-greed, a non-greedy mind. Right intention, by right intention, the Buddha also meant the intention for non-ill will and non-harming. So the intention to bring to an end the tendencies of mind for ill will and for harm. And the aggression, the acts of aggression, are very much a part of harming. So aggressive actions cause harm. And so the intention in the teachings and in the practice is to incline the mind. And the Buddha described an intention as an inclination. It's a leaning of the mind in a certain direction. So leaning the mind towards non-ill will and non-harming. And the practices, the meditations, are to come to understand body-mind, to understand the way the mind works, to understand the way emotions work, to understand what emotions are, and through that to understand aggression in a way that the underlying causes of the aggression come to an end. So if we think about the underlying causes, we see that the aggression comes out of the emotions. So we look at what are the underlying causes of emotions. So we could take anger. So aggression very commonly comes out of anger. So if we look at anger, what are the underlying causes of anger? And so if I look at my anger and I just reflect on, okay, times when I feel angry, what's underlying that? So at times I get angry because I want something and I'm not getting it. Okay? So this is time of being like a little kid having a temper tantrum. There's something I want and I'm not getting it. So I want that. Okay? And if that desire is so strong enough, if we get caught up in that desire so strongly, the anger builds and builds, and then the aggression can come out of that. Okay, so anger comes out of not getting what I want. Sometimes when I'm angry, I see that it's because I have something that I don't want. Or something happens to me that I don't like. Okay? Someone does something to me, or someone says something to me, and I don't like it. And I get angry at that person. And again, if that anger gets strong enough, out of that anger can come an act of aggression. So anger from getting what I don't want. Another cause of anger is when I don't understand something, when I don't know something, or I make an assumption about something. So, what would be an example? I have an appointment with someone. Okay, we're supposed to have an individual meeting out here at 2 o'clock. And 2 o'clock comes, and I look at my watch. Oh, it's 2 o'clock. You're still not there. I look at my watch again. It's 5 minutes past 2. Where are they? They're late. Someone else is coming in 5 minutes, and they're going to be late, and the whole day is going to be ruined. 10 minutes after, still not here. Oh, that person, oh, they've got a lot of nerve putting their name down for a meeting, and they're not showing up. And the anger starts. And then I'm thinking, oh, that stupid person, I'm wasting my time.
I just did that to two people today.
Be careful.
Today.
And then, you did it the other day too. And then half an hour later, somebody comes along and says, oh, so-and-so had a meeting with you, but they got sick. And I think, oh, God. I was so angry at that person. And it's, and the person is sick. So I get angry because there's something that I don't know. And that anger, again, can become aggression. Okay, so the Buddha said that the three underlying causes of dukkha, the three underlying causes of suffering are greed, hatred, and delusion. Okay, so greed is wanting what I don't have. Hatred is not wanting what I have. And delusion is not knowing something. And so these three qualities, these three states of mind are the underlying condition. And when I can understand this and recognize, right in the moment, when I can recognize, here's greed showing, here's anger showing, hatred showing, here's delusion showing, then it cuts the power of the emotion. And so the emotion is reduced and the aggression doesn't come. So that's how we can work with aggression and bring suffering to an end by bringing aggression to an end.
I think there's only time for one more, so I'll save mine for the talk tomorrow night. No, I'll save it. So you keep holding this.
Okay, one more. Oh, that's too bad. Okay, I'll do a couple more, real quick. These ones were written in Hebrew, and I'm sorry I can't answer in Hebrew. Why should we connect to our body if it changes all the time? So we connect to the body because it changes all the time. So seeing the body changing all the time, by connecting to it, by connecting with the body, by giving the attention to the body and to the changing in the body, hopefully we'll become so convinced that the body really is changing all the time, become so convinced that we'll realize that we can't hold on to the body. And then we'll let go of the identification with the body as being me. The body is just the body. It's not me. And in that letting go, the suffering comes to an end. Doesn't mean the body goes away. Doesn't mean the discomfort ends. Doesn't mean pleasant ends. Again, as Molly was saying, it's just the change in the relationship. We know change, we know the impermanence of body so clearly that we don't hold on to it. How should we deal with movements of body coming from something releasing or from pain? Okay, so sometimes in the sitting, sometimes there's a sense or an actual experience of something in the body being released. Sometimes it's a sense of just of energy being released. Sometimes there's a sense of perhaps some emotion being released. Sometimes there's a sense of something physical, just the muscles relaxing. And there's a sense of release. And sometimes the release can be strong enough that it can actually cause physical movement of the body. So body sometimes, I've seen a couple of times bodies actually start bouncing up and down. Or sometimes just some shaking. Or sometimes I've experienced myself, the body just starts turning. And just from the movement of the energies and from the releases of the tensions in the body. So how should we deal with this? With metta. Difference between anicca and anatta. Okay.
Careful.
Very brief. So last night I spoke about these three characteristics of impermanence, of unsatisfactoriness, and of not selfness. Without selfness, without self-centeredness. Okay, so anicca means impermanence. Anicca is the Pali word for impermanence. Anatta is the Pali word for without selfness. Okay, so the two are seen as kind of separate characteristics, but they're actually very much interconnected. So the anicca, the impermanence, actually shows us the anatta. Okay, so the not selfness, it can be seen through the change. So as conditions change, the sense of self changes. As conditions change, the actual appearance of self changes. And so the change shows the not selfness. So as the weather changes, the self changes. Gets warmer, generally the body relaxes. Gets colder, body tenses. Gets warmer, and the mind goes, this is really nice. Gets much warmer, and it's too hot. Gets colder, and it's I wish it would be warmer again. So the body-mind is affected by the environment, and it changes in response to that interconnectedness, that non-separateness, the non-selfness. Okay? Anatta means non-separateness. So what we refer to as self isn't separate from the environment. It's not separate from other people. So when I'm talking with someone who's really angry, maybe I get angry back. So I've been affected by that. If I meet someone who's really peaceful and calm, it helps me to be peaceful and calm. So there's a non-separateness there. So that's the anatta. And the change shows the anatta. And then the second part of that question is, how can one deepen the insights into it? Just by knowing it. By knowing it so deeply, that it just permeates, the knowing of anatta permeates every cell of the body, of the being. And the anicca, the knowing of anicca, the experience of anicca, it's experienced in every cell of the being. And then we know there's nothing to hold on to. And I have to just emphasize again that this doesn't mean that there is no self here. There is a self, but the self exists only in dependence on and only in relation to other selves. Okay. So that's all the time we have. So let's just sit together quietly for a couple of minutes.